Matthew chapter 7, as we look at perhaps the second most well-known passage, at least the second most quoted passage in all the sacred scriptures, usually quoted by people you wouldn't expect to know much about the Bible. Judge not, lest ye be judged. We're looking here, chapter 7, verses 1 through 12 tonight. The end of the Sermon on the Mount is two ways that are offered to us, and we'll conclude with those next week. But we want to look at this passage that challenges us immediately following Jesus' command to seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all things shall be given to you as well. Chapter 7, verse 1, do not judge, lest ye be judged, is the King James Version, or you will too will be judged. This is one of those passages you hear people often quote, even if they have no knowledge of the Bible, if they're completely unchurched, because it's a passage that allows us to put up a bit of a protective guard against what is uncomfortable for all of us, and that is to feel condemned, to be judged, to feel like we're being looked down upon. And so it's very easy to revert to this passage and say, hold on a second, Jesus said, don't judge me. And you hear that a lot. I get that a lot from my family. We use that quite a bit. Don't judge me. Don't judge me. And it strikes a chord, and it strikes such a chord, it's actually a tagline for our church. You know how things have taglines? If you go to our church's website, ever since I've been pastor here, so I know it precedes me, we've had that saying, no judgments, just Jesus, which is meant to connect to that saying, judge not lest ye be judged. The problem with any tagline, which is the size that could fit on a bumper sticker, is there's more nuance than it initially seems, because no judgments, just Jesus includes a judgment. And the judgment is just Jesus. We have decided or discerned or evaluated or appraised that just Jesus is the standard by which we're going to move forward. So no judgments except for this one, just Jesus. So that what we're saying with no judgments has to mean more than just don't discern, don't evaluate, don't appraise, don't critically think through something so you come to some kind of moral conclusion. It has to do more with no judgmentalism or no condemnation. It's not our role or our place to condemn others. We're not in the position of God. But you can see how hard it is to nuance that. I mean, you really got to shave that out, because we're using the same words, don't judge me, or judge wisely. The New Testament uses the same words too, so that we're always in need of thinking of the context in order to understand what is being said. But here Jesus just flat out says, don't judge or you too will be judged. So we have to tweak out as best we can what he's actually inviting us to do as a community of faith, calling us to really deep thinking about judgment, judging, discerning, thinking, assessing, all of those things. And I find it a very important exercise for us as a community of faith, and that's why I find it so lamentable that the passage we're going to study tonight, chapter 7, verses 1 through 12, if I followed the lectionary, we'd never touch it. The lectionary completely ignores it. It never, ever, you could, if you followed the lectionary, you'd never look at these verses all your life. The lectionary are the prescribed readings for the church that are in a 3-year cycle. And they just literally, there is no place for this. It doesn't exist. And it strikes me as somewhat odd, particularly because it's in the Sermon on the Mount, and particularly because it strikes such a chord with unchurched and unbelievers, and particularly because it demands us to really think about the difference between critical judgment, constructive criticism, if you will, and deconstructive criticism, where we're harming others with our evaluations and assessments of them. And it may do us well to spend some time here. So what's interesting, I've preached for 22 years being paid for it, and then a few years prior to that, and I've never preached this passage. Ever. And that wasn't because I was beholden to a lectionary. It's just I've never had to just specifically go through this passage. So it's been a delight to work through this. And I'm going to offer a resource that may help you delve further into it if this strikes a chord with you. So when we talk about judge not lest ye be judged, one of the things that Jesus is inviting us to is to really think about what righteous judgment is. Because we do have to navigate the difficult waters between making judgments, because we can't stop making judgments. All of you made a judgment to brave the cold and come here tonight. You decided, then made a commitment, you assessed the worth, and you said, it's worth more coming to church tonight than it is to stay home in a nice warm place where I can just be real relaxed and watch whatever's on tonight. You made a critical assessment and a judgment, and you then acted on conviction to move forward and to do something about the judgments you've made. We all make judgments, and it's impossible not to. But there is a distinct difference between making judgments and being judgmental. We all make judgments when we assess something, when you decide that you'd rather buy the Walmart tube socks instead of, you know, the more expensive tube socks. When we evaluate something and say, you know, I'd rather watch this program than that program. When teachers have to grade performances, which is important for the growth of students, they have to evaluate and think, is this meeting the standard I'm looking for? When we discern, and the scriptures are full of language on discernment, the Proverbs, the book, if nothing else, is about discerning the right path from the wrong path. So that you're constantly thinking, what is the wise way, the right way, the good way? We all know this. It's perfectly acceptable to make judgments of evaluating actions and behavior when it brings hurt and damage and pain to another person. If we don't make a judgment when someone's actions or behaviors are bringing hurt and damage and pain to another person, we are losing any sense of a conscience. And the whole idea of a conscience is that voice in our head that says, you know, that doesn't seem right. That's wrong. And in doing that, we're making a judgment. A world without conscience. You know what a sociopath is, don't you? They're a person without conscience. They're a person without any kind of moral touchstone whatsoever. We are not being expected to have no conscience. Jesus has told us too many times in this sermon alone, don't do this, don't do that, do this, do that. So that He's inviting us to discern. The sermon will end with there are two ways. There's a narrow and wide gate. There's a tree and its fruit. There are good prophets. There are false prophets. It's wise to build your house on the rock. You better not build your house on the sand. So He's going to invite us to numerous judgments, revealing that we can't live our lives completely value neutral. We can't live in moral indifference. So He's not inviting us to never make assessments, never discern. But it seems what He is suggesting that we all have a problem with is not constructive criticism, but deconstructive criticism, where we are criticizing to condemn, where we are focusing on fault-finding rather than looking at what might be of value. When we criticize without caring and we're quick to condemn another, that seems to be what Jesus is trying to pull out of His community of faith, this judgmental, fault-finding, deconstructively critical spirit that is unhelpful to a community of faith. So He says to His listeners, do not judge or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Now some people have tried to navigate the difficult waters of making judgments and being condemning by saying, well, here's really all that's involved. Whatever standard of judgment you have is the standard by which you'll be evaluated. To which I say, well, then I need to lower my standards. That's not what Jesus is trying to say. He's not trying to say, you make sure your standards are so low, when God judges you in light of the judgments you make, you'll get off squeaky clean. The standards He's given us are the standards we see in this sermon, which we all know by this point lift us to a very high calling and a very difficult challenge in following in the way of our Lord. What He wants to root out from us is this proclivity we have, this proclivity to exaggerate others' faults while minimizing our own. You could put it simply, making ourselves the hero of the story and everyone else is a villain, or at least a potential villain. that we always do what's right and we don't think about thinking about how others are also, for the most part, trying to do what's right. So that in order to get that proclivity out of us, this proclivity to exaggerate others' faults and minimize our own, he offers this in verses 3 through 5, which I can assure you was meant to be a little bit of a humorous portion of the sermon. Verse 3, "Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye?" Now, if Jesus was a carpenter and not a mason, the word could mean either things. He's very familiar with getting a speck of sawdust in your eye, knowing that can be troublesome, but that's certainly by no means as troublesome as having a plank hanging out of your head. So he's trying to draw the difference between this very small thing that we think is a plank in our brother's eye and this very big thing that we don't even notice. Exaggerating others' misbehavior, others' faults, and minimizing our own. So in verse 4, how can you say to your brother, "Let me take that speck out of your eye," when all the time there's a plank in your own? You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye, and then you'll see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. It seems to me Jesus is saying this. He is telling us our sad situation. This situation that comes about from us doing our best to live as moral beings in God's universe, to make discernments, to think about things, to think critically, to judge, to try to do the right thing, that far too often we give ourselves a lot of slack and we don't give others any slack. That we're far more willing to cut ourselves, you know, all kinds of possibilities and loopholes where we're not quite as ready to do that for others. So that Jesus is not suggesting that the world is divided between judgmental people and non-judgmental people. I think he's saying this: we're all judgmental in some ways. We're all non-judgmental in others. It just depends on what thing you're interacting with. But that's something that we all have to wrestle with. If you think about it, and I've seen this happen before, I'm sure I've been guilty of it. Even people who are harshly critical of judgmental people, you know, they're so judgmental, are being judgmental about the judgmental person. I hope you're following that, because that can happen. There is this intolerance of intolerance that can happen in our culture where you have a narrow-minded defender of open-mindedness. I mean, they're all for open-mindedness, but they're narrow in their defense of it, because if you don't share their same stance, you're subject to condemnation for not sharing that stance. And you begin to see how difficult it is to really be non-judgmental, non-condemning, and how Jesus is essentially saying what we always ought to remember, that the line between good and evil is not outside of us, it cuts within us, and that's why he says, take care of your own problems first. Why don't you, for every finger you point at others, point the other three back at yourself? Give more thought to your own issues and challenges, because you're the only one that knows those. You don't really know that person's life, their situation, what they've been through, what maybe the advances they've already made as you condemn them. You just don't know. So he's inviting us to not exaggerate others' faults, but to make sure that we've made as much out of our own as we can, so we're not so quick to minimize others. I think the reason, at least the two reasons I can figure, and there are certainly more, that we are so prone to exaggerating others' faults, is it sure feels good, doesn't it? I mean, it feels good to think that I'm superior to someone else whose moral standard is, you know, so much less than mine. It just feels good. It's nice to prop up on that person's backside and realize, you know, this person compared to me is really, you know, not at all where they should be. There's a certain joy in that, to think that I have this kind of superior sainthood compared to this struggling sinner. So we have that we have to wrestle with. But I also think there's an intellectual superiority. And you'll notice the thing in common with both of these is superiority, which as soon as you hear that word, you ought to immediately think pride, because pride is all about wanting to be better than others. But the intellectual superiority is somehow, with my brilliant way of evaluating things in light of the height of moral aptitude that I have developed, this person is not living like they should, acting like they should, thinking like they should, behaving like they should. It's nice to be able to think that I can know everything about this other person's life and evaluate them just like God would. And the reason why I think there is that intellectual superiority is there's always the temptation to God lust, to want to be as God, to put ourselves in the judgment seat and say, we'll decide who's in, who's out, who's right, who's wrong, who's good, who's bad. I'll make that judgment. And the fact is, in the Scriptures, we've never ever been given that seat of judgment by God to declare someone condemned and forsaken of God. Or to say, you know, this person's definitely in. So we need to be careful with that kind of language. And the reason we need to is because we need to pay attention to ourselves so that we remain in a stance of humility rather than in a stance of superiority. One of my favorite quotes for keeping the superiority in the place it ought to be, and that's under my feet as best as possible, is that quote that you're all familiar with by Philo of Alexandria, at least it's attributed to him: be kind, for everyone you know is fighting some kind of battle. I love that quote. I mean, that just preaches volumes with how many words? 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 words. Be kind, for everyone you know, even the people you don't like, even the people that are your enemies, even the people you completely and utterly disagree with, they are fighting a kind of battle you can't understand. You just can't. You're not God. Only God can. And so at the very least, we ought to, instead of pointing our fingers of accusation, be praying and interceding on their behalf, or perhaps be in a stance where we're ready to wipe away tears, if need be, on their behalf. Because everyone really is fighting a battle. All the battles are different. They all are important in the eyes of God, and they all need to be recognized. And it seems to me Jesus is trying to get his community of faith to think with the eyes and the mind and the heart of God, to have that sense of mercy and compassion and empathy, to not write off anyone. The Son of Man did not come to be serve and be served, but to seek and save the lost. That to have that mindset in our lives. So you have all of that going on to make sure we don't exaggerate others' problems and minimize our own. And then you have the very odd verse, verse 6, to wrap this section up, which much ink has been spilt on what's going on here. It's an odd verse, so I want to at least mention it. Do not give dogs what is sacred. Do not throw your pearls to pigs. If you do, they may trample them under their feet and then turn and tear you to pieces. There's a number, gosh, so much ink has been spilt. Some people say this is Jesus' way of saying some people can't appreciate the kind of constructive criticism you might want to give them at the time. They're just going to trample it under. So realize that, you know, sometimes it's just not right. Even if you think you have the right answer, it's not the right time. Others will say that this is Jesus admitting that there are things beyond our power to help or to heal. I remember hearing Dr. Lore, of all things. I used to listen to her occasionally on the way to work back in Indianapolis when I knew what stations were what. And she would say, you know, some people's lives are so messed up, there's nothing you could say that's going to help them. I mean, the hole's so deep that there's more needed than just, you know, offering a word of advice or constructive criticism. That it's, you know, it's just really, it involves, it demands so much more. So that may be what Jesus is getting at. I think that I would hate for verse 6 and its ambiguity to take away from what is so clear in verses 1 through 5. And in light of that, let me offer a couple of reflections before we round out the rest of this, because this whole section goes together. It seems to me that Jesus is hinting at the fact that to move from self-righteousness, a place of superiority, to compassion and mercy, the first thing we have to recognize is that we're broken and flawed too. That we need to be looking at ourselves and recognize that perhaps too often we're seeing a speck and we're failing to see the real challenge that comes from our side of of the building. The second thing he's trying to do, and I've mentioned this already a number of times, he's trying to build a community of disciples. And he wants the disciples to dwell together and live in a community where they are building on relationships that are preserved by mutual care and compassion. He knows that if you have a community where everyone's biting and devouring each other, where they're just condemning each other, where they see all the faults in the others instead of what is of value and significance, then there will never be a community at all. So he wants the community not to feed off of what others are doing wrong, but to think about themselves and what they may need to do differently in order that they can truly be a people that are united, where there's a community of people receiving and welcoming, a community where the first word isn't, "You aren't welcome." Because we condemn the way you're dressed, we condemn the way you look, we condemn the things you think, we condemn the party you embrace. He doesn't want that to happen. He instead wants to create a community where people are welcome, even people that we highly disagree with, where they are welcomed and not rejected as worthless. Again, it just kind of comes back to, I think the worst feelings I've ever felt in the world is when I felt like in the midst of a group of people, I was judged. That I wasn't wanted. I had less dignity, or I was dumber than them, or I had less value than them because of how I dressed or how I looked or what I thought. And that's something Jesus is trying to keep from the community of faith. Which then takes us to the next section. And what's interesting is these sections are connected. They actually go together. Ask, seek, and knock. And you're all of these we've heard before. Verse 7, ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. He who seeks finds. And to him who knocks, the door will be open. Now, usually we read that detached from its context. But this immediately follows Jesus lifting up this highest standard of mercy and compassion and empathy and saying, I want you to be welcoming, I want you to be gracious, merciful, and I know it's hard. It's not going to be easy. In fact, everything we've read in this sermon challenges us. And so in light of the challenge he's just presented, he wants us to know that we're invited to ask, to seek, to knock, and to know quite clearly that if we do, the Father he's been talking about is good. And the Father wants us to ask and seek and knock. Seek ye first the kingdom of God. This is carrying on that idea. He wants us to know that God's more interested in us than anyone else. And that God's more trustworthy than anyone you trust. So that, for example, he goes on, verse 9, which of you, if his son asks for bread, will give him a stone? And if he asks for a fish, will give him a snake? So if you, and he's talking to all of us, if you tend to give good things to people you love and you don't give them bad things, if you then, though you are evil, thanks for the very candid talk, Jesus. You know, this isn't Jesus saying you're all so cute and cuddly and I love you so. He just called you evil. And me too. If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, that is that we tend to see, you know, not the plank in our eye, that kind of thing. We tend to be ignorant of our own sin and of our own failings and shortcomings. We don't love God as we should. We don't love others as we should. If we do this, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? Which is to say, we as humans, even the best humans, the best, have shortcomings and flaws. And they fail to always do what's right. But there's one who will never fail to do what's right. And there's one who will never neglect you. And that is your Heavenly Father. And so you can approach your Heavenly Father knowing that there is a deep interest in your life. A deep interest in knowing you, providing for you, loving you, caring for you. That all of that's going on with God, so that we should never ever as Christians use this kind of language that you'll sometimes hear from Christians.
You know, I can't trouble God with my problems. There's war and famine stuff going on. You know, there's refugees. And so what's God going to have to say about mine? There's so many other troubles going on. Well, first off, God's not so little that God has to focus all God's energy on one spot and none other can be elsewhere. That's how we are. Instead, God is able to give full attention so that N.T. Wright writes this: God's just as concerned about things as we are. If He is a father, let's treat Him as a father. Not a bureaucrat or a dictator who wouldn't want to be bothered with our trivial and irrelevant concerns. Precisely because there's nothing trivial and there's nothing irrelevant. And so if you think about the sermon so far, Jesus is saying, ask, seek, knock. You have challenges with anger? Ask, seek, knock. You have challenges with wealth and the idol of mammon? Ask, seek, and knock. You have challenges with being too judgmental over others? Ask, seek, and knock. Don't ever think that God's not interested in you seeking to grow and to learn in these contexts. With all of these things, that God has time for us and God wants to know us. This is the attitude from which Jesus ministers. In His life, He will constantly be aware that He has a good Father who wants to be asked, who wants to be sought, who wants to be approached. He'll remember that and He'll constantly do that, and He wants His followers to have that same Abba relationship with God. Which then leads to the climax of the sermon. This is the climax, because from here on out, He's essentially going to say, you have two ways ahead of you. Broad and narrow. False prophets, good prophets. House on sand, house on rock. It's all going to be about two ways. But before He gets to that two ways, He caps it all off with what we've come to call the golden rule. And again, it's important to put it in context. So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. You ready? For this sums up the law and the prophets. Now, if you go back to chapter 5, keep your finger there. Chapter 5, verse 17. When He began this sermon, He said, do not think that I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I've not come to abolish, but to fulfill them. And we've understood as we've gone through this that He is showing us how that fulfillment lives and shows itself in light of His coming. That it's not just the law and prophets anymore, but it's the law and prophets as seen through the lens of Jesus Christ. He's not come to wipe them away. He's come to show us how they are lived. And so He ends in verse 12 again in chapter 7. This sums up the law and prophets. Do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. He puts the law and prophets into one succinct statement. Now, what's interesting about that statement is there's nothing unique about it. All you have to do is do a little research on the so-called golden rule, and you'll find rabbis were speaking of it. Buddhists have something very similar. Confucius has something like this. There's stuff like this in Islam. The lesson here isn't novel. And that troubles some people. They go, oh my gosh, Jesus is ripping off all those other guys. That's not the concern. In the book of Proverbs, many of those proverbs aren't novel too. They're shared by the surrounding culture. What is novel is the context in which Jesus has put that rule. Do unto others as you've done unto them. Now, the fear of doing unto others as I would like to have done unto me is far too often like my kids. My kids would do this all the time. They don't do it as much anymore. They're sick of my response. They'll treat each other badly. Someone will do something bad. You know, Adam will do something bad to Owen, and Owen's going to do the same thing back to him. And, well, he did it to me. Oh, right. That's because the rule says do to others as they do to you. Right, Owen? Do unto others as you'd have them do unto you, or you'd like them to do unto you. But isn't it far too often, well, he did it to me, so I'll do it back to him. I mean, I'll treat others the way they treat me. So if you treat me with respect, I'll treat you with respect. You show me dignity, I'll show you dignity. You show me love, I'll show you love. And that's just natural human nature. Jesus is saying, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. But that then puts our lives at a risk. Because if Adam keeps treating Owen like that, and Owen starts treating Adam like he'd want to be treated, and Adam takes advantage of that. Adam is here tonight, isn't he? Hello, Adam. Sorry about that. Let's make Adam the good guy. No, I'm just kidding. then all of a sudden, you know, Owen's put his life at risk. He's the one getting hurt again and again. And what Jesus is doing with this, he's putting into the context that you can find your foundation, your sense of self, your sense of knowing you're cared for, loved, appreciated, welcomed, shown mercy, empathized with, in the fact that you have a Father who will always listen, who always cares, who always loves, who knows your every need. And it is that foundation of rooting the golden rule in the love of God, which knows no end, that makes Jesus' teaching here distinctly unique. He is saying, essentially, followers, you don't need to attend to your own interest first, even though we want to attend to our own interest first. You're free to do other to others as you'd want them to do unto you, because you're resting in a love where you're always treated justly, rightly, truly, mercifully. You're rooted in the love of God, which is a stable and firm foundation. And it's that kind of stability that will allow Jesus to go to the cross and not do unto others as they've done to him, but to do unto others as he'd have them do unto him, to love them and to save them. So it's a very interesting thing to realize, well, this is not novel what Jesus is saying, but the context in which he's giving it is very novel, because no one up to this point in Revelation of Scriptures has spoken so intimately and deeply of the Father's empathy, care, compassion, mercy, love, kindness, continual provision, constant interest like Jesus has. And so it's that that he's asking us to rest in. Well, that then ends the major portion of what Jesus wants to get across as he invites us to think about how it is we would like to be treated and to do unto others to that end, which leads me to these last two final reflections. And the first one I've already shared with you, but I have to remind you, because you guys know the constant conflict I have with the lectionary. I follow the church here. I don't necessarily follow the lectionary passages. This is one of the reasons. Because there are numerous times where whole passages are just wrenched and thrown away. I mean, they're just not, they're never even touched. If you've lived in a church that only used the lectionary, you'd never study this passage. You'd never encounter it. That's a shame. I mean, that's lamentable in its highest form. I don't know what else to do with that other than say, I don't know who was thinking that. Who put this together? What bonehead did this? And they're a bonehead. Sorry about that. Microphone's popping. Which then leads to, well, you know what? Jesus said, don't call anyone Raca idiot or you'll be in dangers of the fire of hell earlier. Not a bonehead. So quick to judge. See, there he goes. Look, boom, in the middle of delivering this. Golly. I got to keep asking and seeing and knocking. All right, so where this leads, the goal. God forgive me. The goal is Jesus is trying to create with this sermon a humble community of compassionate individuals who are seeking God. Ask, seek, and knock. They're humble because they're not judging. They're compassionate, so they're considering their own self and their challenges first, and you know, not exaggerating others and minimizing their own, so there's compassion and empathy. These individuals are seeking God. They're asking, seeking, and knocking. And they're seeking because they are doing unto others as they would like it to be done unto them, seeking to be God's instruments of mercy to others. Instead of treating people as they've been treated, they're invited to treat others in the way God has treated them and continues to treat them and forever will treat them, with mercy and kindness and grace. And so you begin to see what Jesus' dream is for the church, and it's a beautiful picture. It's one of those things that only grace can create, only mercy and compassion can create, and it thus becomes a beautiful picture from Jesus of what he hopes for his kingdom community that is being fashioned here with its founding document, this Sermon on the Mount. So may God grant us the grace to live up to this. May God grant us the grace to evaluate ourselves wisely, rightly, truly, and to look at others with as much grace as we possibly can. Because we all know this, do unto others as we'd like others to do unto us. The last thing we want others to do unto us is condemn us and judge us. It's the last thing we want. And that's how all of this then connects together. Worship team, if you'd make your way up here, we got just a few minutes if there are any thoughts or comments as they're making their way up here. Got one more week in Sermon on the Mount. We'll look at these two ways because those two ways are important. Back here.
We often talk about the constructive versus deconstructive criticism in the IRA, where we're like writing critiques.
Right.
So good criticism makes the people see what they're doing wrong so they can do it right next time. Whereas bad criticism is just like, okay, you're doing it all wrong. And
right. Good. I like that idea of constructive and deconstructive. I came up with that term deconstructive criticism, but it may not be unique to me. Not deconstruction, that's its whole other thing, but I just thought that's kind of the opposite. You're tearing someone down instead of trying to build them up. Constructive is you're wanting the best. You're trying to help improve someone. Even that can have its own hidden little, mousetrap to it, though. Because sometimes we're trying to improve others and they don't want to be improved. Or they don't, maybe that's not on their top shelf. Now in a choir class, that's obvious. You're trying to get a song, but, in other things, that might be a little bit more challenging.
I have a question. If you come to a point in your life where you feel like being critical of a person is helping move you in the right direction, can criticism be right for you?
Boy, that would all depend on the unique situation. I don't know. I do know this. Matthew chapter 18, verses 15 through 20 is the place where Jesus will talk about if you have an issue with your brother or sister, go to them. Share it with them. If they won't hear, now this is talking about church life, then go with a couple of others that are seeking reconciliation, seeking healing and all that. If they still won't listen, then, all of a sudden you end up with this situation where there can be no reconciliation. You have to kind of move on from there and decide how you're going to move forward. So Jesus himself kind of gives this process within the church life. I don't know how, there are certainly ways you could translate that in unique ways to whatever situation you have of confronting, challenging, and then maybe having to either move on or maybe being successful. Because we all know there are things like interventions, to get into extreme things. Where interventions have to take place and stuff like that. So, good question. Wish I had a better answer. Back here and we're done. Last one. I think my simple way of doing it is constructive is trying to help the person, just as I said to your brother, deconstructive is harmful. In his situation, constructive would be, I can help you get that pitch. I can help you, maybe you're singing the melody just a little bit off rhythm. Deconstructive would be, you suck. You really can't sing worth a hoot. I don't know if you can ever do this. And where you're really tearing the person down instead of trying to help them improve and get better and be built up. So I think that'd be the difference between those two. The challenge, and I didn't mention this at all, but I know at least one or two of you know this because you have a background in this. It's interesting to look. I've done my best to try to say we've got to figure out how to discern and yet not condemn, because we can't ever lose judging in the sense that we make judgments, but we don't want to condemn others. We don't. That's not our place. We're not God. We're not superior. We got to look to our own self. But there is a very interesting teaching that all the desert fathers and mothers held, and almost all the church fathers. If you read any of the church fathers, those writing in the first 6 centuries of the church, any of the desert fathers and mothers who went away to the desert to evaluate their own hearts and wrestle with God, they all write very consistently, never judge. Never. Never judge. So in their mind, and I tell you, I tend to lean towards that teaching, they say it's just never our place to condemn, ever. Now, how could I do that if I were a judge? So that I didn't have to. That'd be part of my... So I don't know how you fit that into all of life, but I do know that their idea was be very, 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 very careful if you ever write off somebody. Because you may be doing something God would never want you to. So, you know, it's a really challenging thing to do. And I think for me, when I get hung up on those real extreme examples at the margins, I kind of come back to the middle and say, most of my life, 99.9% of my life, I don't have to deal with those extremes. I have to just deal with the reality that I got to watch my judgmentalism. And then I kind of come back to that and figure if I can get some traction there, then if those extremes ever arise, I'll be in a better place to deal with them if I've dealt with these more local issues about my own life and my own experience than jumping to, you know, can I condemn Hitler kind of thing. All right. So...